UK Wine Show, show number 151. Wine and Spirit Trade Association with Gavin Partington. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 151 for the 10th of April 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Gavin Partington from the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. We talked to Gavin a bit about what the Wine and Spirits Trade Association is and how do they work. In the spotlight, we review Oz Clark's Wine Atlas. And in this week's quote, we have Sparkling Muscadet, one of the finest of Idaho. Who said that? Clues throughout the show, answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. First Quench have issued another 40% off voucher on wine and champagne at any of its Threshers, Wine Rack, Victoria Wine or Bottoms Up stores over the Easter weekend until April the 13th. The voucher is central to First Quench's promotional programme, with key periods such as Christmas and Valentine's Day being targeted. To get hold of a voucher, just text WINE to 600040.
40% off is a fairly big discount, but not long to go before it's gone. Bordeaux prices might be coming out at a discount as well. What's the story about En Premier tasting this week, Jane?
Well, the Berry Brothers and Rudd verdict on the 2008 Bordeaux is that it's a mixed bag in terms of quality. After 6 days of tasting, the Berry Brothers team selected just 42 out of the 385 wines tasted, which, subject to price, they will offer to customers. They say they have no plans to buy stock for the future, at least not until sterling recovers against the euro. The team's top selections included Chateau de Tertre, Chateau d'Angleterre, and Chateau d'Armeac. Meanwhile, unexpectedly early, Chateau Angelou released their prices for 2008 en premier at the same price as 2004 in euros, but equivalent now to £725 per case in bond. Prices are normally released 3 weeks after the tasting.
This is turning out to be a very interesting en premier campaign, with many people saying the vintage is better than the 2007, but the world economy in trouble. What price all the wines will release at? Who knows, but certainly an erosion on the 2005 pricing, which saw a big step up in prices in 05, 06 and 07, looks certain. Demand will be down due to the economy, but world consumption is also falling. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, wine consumption around the world has fallen by 1%, according to the 2008 edition of Global Drinks Market Impact Data Bank Review and Forecast. Declines in Western Europe have cancelled out the gains made in emerging markets, with the total world wine consumption standing at 2.65 billion 9-litre cases. This means consumption has now been in decline for 3 consecutive years after 5 years of growth from the beginning of the decade. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website to check out these stories in full, www.3050.co.uk.
Well, what a nice thing to finish up with, world consumption down. But which wines from around the world are best? That's what Oz Clark's Wine Atlas can tell you. Next up in the spotlight, we have the book review, Oz Clark's Wine Atlas. Okay, Oz Clark's Wine Atlas, second edition. Oz Clark's Wine Atlas is a full detailed book on the world of wine. With Oz's chatty writing style, the book is easy to read, but this is a reference work and not meant to be read cover to cover. Divided into 2 sections, the first covers the basics of wine growing and some very good explanations on the importance of climate. I especially like some of the definitions of soil and the climate zone maps, which included some of the most important sea currents which drive the climate in wine growing regions. There's an interesting definition of different soil types, and there's an excellent overview on how the lay of the land can change the climate and growing conditions of vines. Section 2 is more your standard wine atlas. It covers all the regions of the world and forms the bulk of the book, covering 300 pages. As with many wine writers, Oz's first love is France, and has a distorted weighting of almost a third of the book at 90 pages dedicated to France. Italy, with its huge range of wines and cultures, receives 33 pages, Spain 20, and the New World countries, which are poorly represented, with Australia receiving the lion's share of 21 pages, Chile only 3, and Argentina 2. Old blighty England receives a single page. So, again, a bit like Jancis and Hugh Johnson's book, heavily weighted to France, with the rest of the world making up the rest. In the end, the quality of a wine atlas is not how many pages are devoted to this region or that region. It's the ability to find the information that you're looking for. For me, a reference book is something that you want to use to dive in and find quickly. In this respect, Ozzie's chatty style lets the book down. His conversational style and lack of headings or bold text make it difficult to find what you're looking for. Indexing is okay, but once you've found the page, you still have to read through a lot of Oz's talk before finding what you're looking for. Any world atlas must have great maps, and Oz's maps are detailed and clear. They're in the form of a relief map, that is, you can see things like hills and forests, etc., with details showing. It's a bit like hovering over the region in a hot air balloon while an artist quickly draws the pictures in front of them. They show roads, hills, forest areas, and key vineyards. But I personally prefer Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson's wine atlas' maps to Oz's. Oz's maps are cleaner and certainly more aesthetically pleasing, but they don't show as much detailed information as the others. In the end, the difficulty in finding detailed information meant I preferred Hugh's and Jancis's wine atlas over Oz's, and I rated this book 89 out of 100. The next book I'm going to review is going to be done in a couple of weeks, is Malcolm Gluck's The Great Wine Swindle. Stay tuned for that. But next, before we get into the interview, I wanted to see how you're getting on with the quote. Sparkling Muscadet, one of the finest wines of Idaho. What movie is that from? It was said by Steve Martin, whose cameo in the movie as an insolent waiter in the 1979 cult movie. Other people involved in the movie include Frank Oz and Jim Henson. Any idea what movie this is? Not sure? Don't worry, it's just a bit of fun. Next up, we have the interview with Gavin Partington from the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, or WSTA, as they're often said. Hi, I'm here with Gavin Partington. You're the spokesman for the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. How are you, Gavin?
Fine, very well, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, what you guys do today. What is the Wine and Spirit Trade Association?
Well, basically, we are the representative body in the UK for the wine and imported spirit businesses, and that those transcend a whole range of companies from suppliers, makers, producers, bottlers, distributors, wholesalers, to, of course, the retail side. We also have the big retailers amongst our membership, as well as the specialist wine retailers in the UK. We lobby, effectively, on behalf of the industry, both at national level but also at European level, because, of course, the nature of the wine business is a lot of the rules and regulations affecting labelling and content is dealt with at a European level, yet a lot of the policies affecting licensing and what you can do in a retail environment too in the UK is dealt with by the domestic government here, both at Westminster but also at Holyrood and the Welsh Assembly and in Northern Ireland. So it's a busy agenda, and we effectively act on behalf of the whole industry in dealing with government and dealing with the rules and regulations affecting the trade, but also defending our members' interests.
Do you go as far as down to, say, the council level, because they're the people who issue licences effectively, or is it more at the more central government level?
We do deal with the councils. Our starting point is really the central government level, but we deal with local government where we are able to have an impact in terms of the licensing rules and regulations affecting our membership. Actually, one of the things that we've been doing very active in recently is something called a community alcohol partnership, which seeks to bring together various partners, the police, local trading standards officers, schools, the trade, retailers, to try and tackle underage alcohol purchase and underage alcohol possession. And that is a scheme that does involve dealing with local councils around the country.
Obviously, the wine spirits industry is sort of on the back foot at the moment with some of the things that are developing in the industry. Do you feel you're reactive, or do you try more to be proactive? And if you're proactive, what sort of things do you try and do?
We do try to be proactive, and I don't feel that we are actually on the back foot. I feel that we as a trade association particularly, and I would say that really most of the trade associations in the alcohol sector have been very proactive at warning their membership about the dangers inherent in some of the proposals which are emanating from government, both at Westminster and in Scotland. What we do is actually pinpoint the areas in which legislation is being mooted and is likely to take take place and we identify flaws, problems, potential benefits too. Let's not be totally negative about this, but usually it is issues where we think that some of the suggestions being put forward by politicians are going to cause problems for our membership. And we work with civil servants and with government and also with our members to try and address those in the best way we can.
I had a look on your website and it sort of defines the key issues as your website anyway, and it was talking things like regulation and trade environment for the production, marketing, sales of wine and imported spirits. So regulation is quite important. How important is the environment? Because how do you push that? Is it about recycling cardboard or glass? Do you get involved in that?
We do get involved in that. Indeed, we're involved with an organisation in the United Kingdom called RAB, which acts on behalf of local authorities and looks at the whole issue of packaging and the extent to which excessive use of packaging can be diminished and how industry can adopt best practice to promote a sustainable future for all. One of the issues here, of course, is that you will be pretty obvious that the bulk of the wine sold in the UK is imported. It yeah. travels a long way and it involves packaging. Mm-hmm. And so these are big issues for the industry. In the past year, we've been involved with one of our members, JF Hillebrand, in developing something called the Carbon Calculator, which is an online tool which enables businesses to calculate very precisely the impact on the environment of their export and import process. So if they're bringing wine from halfway across the world to the UK, they can measure very clearly what impact they're having in terms of carbon. This is a useful tool and part of the work that we do in this area.
Do you start at the beginning of production, or is it more the transport side of things?
This actual business is the transport side of things. The beginning of production is an area where I think there is an eagerness within the industry to look at that yeah. aspect of things. But the carbon calculator itself is focused on the transportation dimension.
Because Hillebrand is a big logistics mover of wine.
It's Hillebrand's expertise in the area of logistics and transportation, which is why we worked with them on it.
Areas that you say you cover is wine and spirit duty.
Yes.
That must be contentious at the moment with the government aiming, is it 2% above inflation?
Well, it's undoubtedly, there's no doubt, Chris, that this has been the big issue for the industry and the drink sector as a whole, to be honest. Over the last year, the March 2008 budget introduced a tax increase of 9%. Yep. 6% above the prevailing rate of inflation. And it also foreshadowed the tax escalator, which is due to kick in at the time of this year's budget, which, as you accurately say, is 2% above the rate of inflation for 4 years.
And then they slipped
and then,
the
of course, it was, it was made worse by the pre-budget report change, which imposed an 8% increase in excise duty, designed to offset the 2.5% reduction in VAT, but yeah. any analysis of the wine market will tell you that for the great bulk of wines sold, which is below the £6 mark,
yeah.
£6.07 to be precise, those wines were actually going to get hit by increased taxation. It wasn't going to be tax neutral, as they claimed.
Does the government plan on pulling that excise duty back when the VAT drops back again?
We hope so. We are campaigning on that at the moment, and we have, for the first time this year, we have come together with the other major trade associations in the drink sector to make a joint budget submission. And that submission argues that the tax escalator should not go ahead, nor should there be any other tax increase brought in this year's budget.
What will happen if we get a bit of deflation? Say it's 3% deflation. Will they drop it, do you think? Or do you think they'll just cap
it? I don't know precisely what they would do, but the way in which they can't make the calculation is apparently they take, at the time of the budget, they take the 6 months inflation figure preceding that date, and then a forecast of the 6 months, what it's going to be for the 6 months ahead.
Yep.
So that situation might arise, and it would be interesting to see how it works out. However, our point is that, we are arguing that really the scale, the excessive nature of the tax increases last year pushed the wine industry to a tipping point. And what we've seen in the past few months is job cuts. And two of the biggest, just to name two, the biggest international wine companies re-looking, reassessing really the scale of their investment in the UK and having to cut back jobs. Constellation,
yep.
Europe of course, and Ian J. Gallo. They've both announced job cuts. And
Gallo's is pretty obvious though, because the change in the American currency versus the pound means that their cheap rosés and all their sort of entry-level wines become not cost effective. They had foreign exchange advantage a couple of
years ago. You're absolutely right, Chris. And I don't let me say clearly now, you know, some of the job cuts we're seeing in the industry is not all due to tax increases. You know, clearly there has been a after many years of growth in the wine market, what we've actually seen in 2008 is a serious rollback in terms of the growth in the sector. In the second quarter, we saw sales go down by, or sales released from bond anyway in the UK, it's a good guide to consumption, down by 5.7%. In the third quarter, it was down by 10.3%.
So that's year on year?
No, that's a per quarter. That's the quarterly fall. Now, that's a significant decrease. What we're seeing in the on-trade is that sales are down. What we're seeing in the off-trade is that they are now flat. And therefore, you know, why would a government at this particular time want to increase duty, particularly when their own figures show that their revenue from excise duty is failing to meet their forecasts? That's what happened in a period last year. And so it's a lose-lose situation at the moment for them. They've increased duty. It's hurting business. Businesses are cutting jobs, which actually has a knock-on impact for governments in terms of the costs associated with unemployment. Plus, they're not getting the revenue from the excise duty. Doesn't make sense. People have got less money in their pockets. I mean, what we saw last year in the market here is quite an interesting dynamic. You know, we saw the tax increases pushing up the price, the average price of a bottle of wine.
Yep.
What then happened during later on in the year is that the big retailers of wine found that, you know, people were starting to feel the pinch, and actually there was a huge pressure to reduce prices, and that meant, frankly, doing deals and reducing margins of producers and so on. So it tilted back down the average price towards the end of the year. The market is very, very sensitive at the moment.
Talking about some of the other issues that you guys deal with, the police don't seem to be policing underage wine sales. You know, it doesn't seem to be something that you see them doing a lot of in terms of actively catching corner store dairy who seems to sell wine. And there's very few licensee holders who seem to get their licenses held back, even if they are caught selling it to underage.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in the off-trade particularly is a massive step up of the efforts to address issues associated with underage alcohol, attempted possession and use. And in autumn 2005, the retail trade rolled out the Challenge 21 scheme.
Mm-hmm.
The Challenge 21 scheme was a determined effort involving staff training, signage, communication both to customers but also to staff about the need for people who looked as though they might be under 18 to provide identification, to provide identification, testifying that they were able and allowed to buy alcohol. Recently, we've actually rolled out Challenge 25 after it had been trialled in a couple of the big retail chains. It had been used both Asda and Morrison's. And the early signs is that that's getting quite a positive response. I think one of the things that has changed here is that young people no longer feel insulted or take umbrage at the idea that somehow they've got to produce ID when they go and buy alcohol.
Yeah.
It's almost taken as read that you will be asked, if you look under 25, you will be asked to prove what your age is.
I know my wife, if she ever gets asked for ID, it hasn't happened quite a while, she was quite stoked.
I think some people would take it as a form of flattery, wouldn't they?
Hasn't happened for a while. Hasn't happened a long time for me. In the States, I lived in Seattle, and they had a under 30. If you looked under 30, you had to prove ID. No 18-year-old can look under 30. You can see how, under some circumstances, someone might look under 21 or 25.
I think the point here is that, you know, retailers actually want to communicate to the outside world they don't want to sell alcohol to people under 18. Right? They don't,
big players because, anyway.
Well, I think most small players don't either. I think that actually where you do find problems occasionally, and there is evidence, I mean, if you speak to the Association of Convenience Stores, they'll tell you that in some areas, smaller retailers get put under a lot of pressure. If you're a small corner shop in the middle of a large estate, and there's a group of kids sitting outside, and when they won't, when you won't sell them alcohol, they cause a disturbance and they threaten to, you know, damage the shop, or they even threaten to damage the person behind the till, then I think that that does create problems for retailers. I'm not suggesting that all retailers are absolutely innocent.
Yeah.
And what we've been very clear about as an organisation is we say, let's have a firm and fair rule for all. Let's punish retailers who get it wrong and who actually sell alcohol illegally to those under 18. But equally, let's ensure that those who attempt to buy alcohol illegally, they get punished too.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. You mentioned in your key issues the modernisation of Her Majesty's revenue and custom procedures. What sort of things does that involve?
That is largely technical, associated with the use of computers and consignment numbers and registration documents online, mm-hmm. To make it possible for areas of the supply chain to compile details and provide information for revenue and customs in a simple and easy way.
Yeah.
It's just really the use of modern systems to effectively develop the processes to save time and money.
Okay, now that makes sense. And the last question I have before we wrap up is, how do you differ from other trade bodies? For example, you have people like the Portman Group who have a similar profile of customers. You have Constellation in your group, but Portman Group doesn't have them. But how do you differ? Because you're both wine spirit.
Well, it's important to understand that the Portman Group actually comprises the nine large producers.
Except for Constellation.
Except for Constellation. But it is a producer-only organisation. Mm. Our membership crucially transcends the producer, distributor, retail end. So we cross over the whole supply chain. And I think that's important because I know that in this sector it's characteristic to think about, it has been in the past, to think about producer interests and retailer interests. The truth of the matter is, a vast amount of the wine sold in the UK is sold and actually wholesaled by the large retailers, the large supermarkets.
Yep.
The idea that simply there are different sections of they're totally divorced or from each other, they're not. They're all part of the drinks industry. It's a huge industry, employs many, many people, and makes a significant contribution to the economy.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Gavin. Thank you very much for your time.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. You may recall we spoke to him about a month ago when we were talking about minimum pricing. Next week, we're going to be talking with Michael Thompson from the Portman Group on what the Portman Group is all about. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with the quote? Sparkling Musket Ale, one of the finest wines of Idaho. If you're not sure who said that, the movie stars green frogs and an aggressive pig. It is, of course, the Muppet Movie. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.